But anyway, I'm here to talk about the cartographic imaginations of cyberspace, and I'm going to be bringing sort of my own disciplinary background as a geographer to take us through some really sort of basic concepts about critically looking at cartographic representations of real world space, and how some of those theoretical concerns might be brought to look at maps of cyberspace, which of course have started to emerge in great numbers. So traditionally, geographers have defined themselves in large part as a group of people whose job it is to go out and make cartographic representations of space. And we have a long and sort of problematic history in my discipline of participation in things like the colonial project, military cartography, land and sea trade, and basically supplying the navigational tools and surveys and graphical representations to make these things possible. And so when people say, I'm a geographer, oftentimes people say, oh, well, you guys make maps, right? Well, I mean, that's sort of the traditional role of geographers, but we've changed a lot, especially since about the mid 20th century. And one of the more recent areas that we've started to explore is to actually sort of critically examine the practice of map making. So I'm going to follow from a guy named Jeremy Crampton, who wrote a book called The Political Mapping of Cyberspace. It's a good book. Who talks about a sort of a divergence in geography between theory and practice, meaning that there still persists a group of people in the discipline who still, practice the job of graphically representing the Earth and are very good at it. And increasingly use computers and computer technology to make those maps. But there's another group of us of which I'm a part who are a little bit more concerned with the theoretical implications of what those other people are doing. I would say that this sort of theoretical or critical approach to cartography probably has its roots in the late 80s with the cultural turn in geography. And particularly with a book by a guy named Monmonier in 1991 called How to Lie with Maps. Another interesting book with sort of lots of interesting little factoids about sort of, why it is that maps don't necessarily realistically represent space. And the simple reason why we need to think about maps as representations rather than as actual realistic bases for reality is that basically maps are two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional space. So you've got a globe, the Earth. It's a complicated spherical object. There's an inherent challenge in taking that space and laying it out flat and depicting it for people. Computers might help solve some of those problems by enabling us to use 3D visualization. But we still face certain compromises and certain choices that these people who are interested in the practice of map making consciously or unconsciously make when they're making maps. And as Monmonier pointed out, they distort reality in very specific ways through their use of scale, their use of projection, and the use of symbols. So this is sort of a very traditional map of the Earth. It's the Mercator projection. How many of you recognize this image from your high school textbooks or your elementary school geography textbooks? Yeah, quite a few. The Mercator projection is a really commonly used map projection. But its original purpose wasn't necessarily to provide the most realistic view of the land masses of the Earth. It was actually better suited as a sea navigational tool because it maintained accurate direction between two points when you're traveling at sea. But what happened was that it actually distorted the area of land masses. So the shape of the continents that we've come to recognize from our high school textbooks in the Mercator projection don't necessarily reflect the actual physical size of those features. So keep an eye on South America and Africa, and I'm going to go forward one slide. This is an equal area world projection. This is very different from the Mercator projection. Its goal is to preserve the area of the land masses. So here it's not very useful as a navigational tool, but it gives a better idea of how much actual surface area is taken up by each of the continents. So you notice the diminutive size of the United States and Europe. And if I'll flip back, you could see how different the two are and what a different idea of the shape of the Earth each one provides. Now, the purpose of these equal area projections weren't just innocently trying to correct an error. There's a bit of a political motivation behind making these maps, and that is to kind of decenter the importance of Europe and North America. In the Mercator projection, they seem to be very, very important, but in the Hobo-Dyer, they're much smaller. I've even seen a Hobo-Dyer map that's been turned upside down to further subvert the Eurocentrism of the Mercator projection. So there's a kind of a political project going on here as well. But beyond altering the scale projection of maps, they can often serve more explicit ideological purposes. And in the series of the next few maps we're going to look at, they basically thematically focus on the theme of proximity to the Soviet Union. This was a theme that came up quite a bit in graphical representations of the Earth during the Cold War period, was the real proximity of the Soviet threat to Western interests. So here they've manipulated the orientation of the map, and this is a map that was originally published in Time magazine in 1952. They've oriented it north-south, or rather west-east. And it gives the idea that the Soviet Union is just sort of right next to Western Europe and about to conquer these territories. Obviously, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, proximity was another important theme and issue. And this is a CIA map that shows the relative ranges of nuclear missiles from Cuba to the United States. And here, the scale, the color, really give a sense of imminent threat. Here's the use of a planar polar projection. And in the context of sort of the air war and the possibility that wars might be fought using missiles rather than actually land troops, these kinds of projections were very persuasive because they showed that actually Canada and the United States weren't so far from the Soviet Union at all if one went over the North Pole. So the planar projection was a sort of a subtle way to show politically how important things like spending on air defense budgets really were during the Cold War. An author, Julian Rose, has brought our attention in geography to the possibility that race and gender relationships might also find their way onto the map sheet. And a good place to look for those kinds of power relations is in colonial maps of the world. Here's a map of Africa from 1771, and I'm not sure if you can read what it says in the upper right-hand corner, so I'll read it out for you. It says, an accurate map of Africa from the latest improvements and regulated by astronomical observations. So they're purporting that to have provided us the most accurate depiction of this continent possible. But of course, we know that it's really just a two-dimensional representation of a very complex space. Here's an example of how gender and race find their way onto these maps. Here's an artistic legend on another map of Africa in 1707. and essentially depicting a bunch of imagined natives lounging around, baring their breasts and sort of not doing a whole lot of work. And this was sort of, you know, supporting the European idea that of racial superiority. So we can see how early colonial maps of Africa racialized, gendered, and even eroticized place through their representations, linking imaginary people to imagined places. Here's an example of sort of the extension of colonial power onto the landscape in postage stamps. It was quite common up until the mid-20th century to put graphical depictions of figureheads on beautiful African landscapes, sort of cementing the European supremacy of these places. So what I'm proposing in my own work, and I'm really still in the preliminary phases of thinking this through, is to follow Crampton's challenge of really critically looking at what we do when we map, and really to take apart this progressivist, objectivist treatment of maps as mirror images of reality, and to say, well, you know, what really goes into the creation of these maps? What kinds of power relations are embedded in these representations? And replace that kind of understanding of cartography with one that's more historically contingent and cognizant of the possibility that social relations and power relations are embedded in maps. And these can be racial, gendered, capitalist, nationalistic. The list goes on. So let's look at some maps of cyberspace, since that's what we're here for. So here's an early graphical representation of Usenet traffic in 1993. And the next three images, by the way, are taken from Dodge and Kitchen's 2002 Atlas of Cyberspace. You can find it online, and it's also available by order for a hard copy. This is a very, very interesting book, lots of cool pictures. I picked out a few that I thought were really interesting and sort of iconic. This one's a depiction of Usenet traffic in 1993. And what I want to draw your attention to is sort of the difficulty that this mapmaker has had in trying to reconcile a real-world spatial geography that's outlined with the continents and this sort of new geography of cyberspace. It seems like the two don't necessarily fit very well together. On one hand, you have this sort of disembodied, diffuse, instantaneous network of telecommunications, and it's overlaid on top of a world of real spatial places and real bodies located in that space. But looking at this map, you get the impression that somebody in Santiago, Chile could instantaneously interact with somebody from New York City, even though there's, you know, thousands of miles and social difference between those two individuals. So the map sort of suggests this liberating possibility for this technology. A lot of people have probably seen this map. It's widely reproduced. It's a map of early NFSnet traffic. As one observer noted, the ARC map is one of the best examples of a representation of the net that goes beyond the practical and taps into a deeper aesthetic feel for what cyberspace looks like. So there's something iconic about this kind of depiction of the internet as a series of trails leading through the sky. To its credit, and unlike the Mercator projection, seems to decenter Europe and the United States. Also, because in the original, the user was able to manipulate it and turn it around and zoom in on any portion of the map that they wanted. It wasn't a static representation here. It was user interactive. But nevertheless, what emerges from this picture is definitely a very, very clear example of the global digital divide. There are places that are completely dark, that are unplugged, that are not connected to the space of international money and culture flows. And there are spaces that are very brightly lit on this map. Now, in a further development of mapping cyberspace, some cartographers have preferred to just drop the real-world cartography altogether. Let it go in favor of focusing on the topological relationship between points and just map out the arcs and nodes of the information backbone. So here's an example of a 3D visualization of skitter data from CADA. And it kind of looks like a globe, but there's absolutely no real-world geographical reference. So here what I would point out to you is the way that this is kind of a almost aspatial. The distances and the actual places matter less than the connections and the network logic that links all these points together. There's a very intense sort of disembodied feeling that we get from looking at this kind of representation. And I'll argue in a few moments that this kind of disembodied, diffuse networks cartography of cyberspace has very specific political ramifications, some good and some bad. Here's one that a lot of you have probably seen hanging out at conferences like this. I was reminded of one of these when I went to a security conference up in Canada, and it seems I've seen these around quite a few places. It's sort of a network security schematic that, again, deterritorializes cyberspace and represents it as a series of interconnected symbols. And here we get a sense of sort of, you know, the blue, cool region of the corporate LAN being protected from the sort of the unknown exterior, you know, potential hacker. So, and this is a type of cartography as well, I would argue, even though it's abstracted. So what does it mean that we've progressed from kind of trying to overlay cyberspatial cartography on top of real-world geography? Well, I would say that geographic imaginations of cyberspace have political and foreign policy implications, and we're starting to see some of those currently, and they've evolved, I think, since about the 1990s. One of them has been a focus on connection to the global network as both a source of security and threat. So what do I mean by that? Well, by security, I am thinking of the sense that connection to the global marketplace renders countries more amenable to, say, American foreign policy interests. I've heard the oft-quoted phrase that no two countries with a McDonald's have ever gone to war with one another, and I'm sort of reminded of that here. Some researchers, Robert Secor and Spark, have argued that what's going on now in foreign policy circles in the United States is that certain parts of the world are being characterized as non-integrating. These are rogue regimes that have no interest at all in connecting up to the global flows of capital, and as such, they represent a threat. So in this new logic, it's disconnection from the network that is the real threat, not connection to it. But on the other hand, as we saw with the security schematic here, there's a sense that if we do connect ourselves up to this global network, this aspatial global network, that we open ourselves up to a whole bunch of, you know, unsavory possibilities. And definitely the global war on terror has assumed many of the same metaphors and symbols that are employed in the internet security field. For example, the White House administration has repeatedly cited the diffused and networked architecture of terrorist organizations as support for the continued military aggression and restriction of movement by citizens into and outside of the country. Here's a map of the 9/11 hijackers, and it's laid out like an arc node map, similar to ones that we've seen, the earlier cyberspatial maps that we've seen. So there's definitely a sort of a rhetorical linkages, I think, between terrorist networks and electronic networks, which I think is very interesting. Now, I've got an interesting quote. This is from a congressional testimony in 2003. This is a network security expert testifying before Congress about the threat that our nation's computers faced when exposed to foreign hackers. He says, "Many more malicious and widespread viruses are seen in the wild on the internet on a daily basis. Many are written with Russian, Chinese, and other language comments in the code. Some have direct ties to organized crime, especially outside the U.S. Many are propagated from commonly known havens for virus writers where there's no fear of legal prosecution or where the technical skills of the government to prosecute are minimal or non-existent." So again, this is sort of reiterating the sense of the cyberspace as a space of threat. What do I mean when I say that network architectures enable both territorialization and deterritorialization. Well, definitely in the big Qaeda jellyfish model of the internet, there's an intense deterritorialization. There's a sense that the internet frees us from our bodies, you know, makes the cultural, social, and actual physical distances between us irrelevant, and renders physical space less important than this new virtual space. I think of that as a kind of deterritorialization. But I think that the internet also enables very particular kinds of territorializations. One example is here in IP geocoding. I understand there's going to be somebody talking about that. I hope that I didn't miss their talk. I hope that's going to be in the coming days. But essentially using people's IPs to grant them access or not grant them access based on the country in which they live. So now there's a relinking of real-world geography to the cyberspatial geography that actually has real material physical outcomes. Here, this is a map of which countries were allowed to access www.georgebush.com prior to 2004 election. And you can see that only Canada and the United States were granted access and successfully blocked everybody else. Citing terrorist and disruptive threats from foreign hackers. And definitely the Army, the United States Army, is interested in cyberspace. Here's a quote from a report by the Project for the New American Century, writing on rebuilding America's defenses. And they consider cyberspace to be one of the key places where they want to extend their control. They say, much as control of the high seas and the protection of international commerce defined global powers in the past, so will control of the new international commons be a key to world power in the future. An America incapable of protecting its interests or that of its allies in space or the infosphere will find it difficult to exert global political leadership. So there's a sense of militarizing and potentially territorializing cyberspace. And definitely .mil is becoming an increasing and growing presence online. So I don't have any really groundbreaking conclusions yet. I'm still in the process of writing all this up. But I think the issues that I've talked about raise a few concerns that might be relevant to us as an audience. And one is, again, to reiterate the question that we should think about, how are power relations that are implicated in real-world maps also possibly implicated in the production of cyberspatial maps? How are hackers and other online groups impacted by this emerging war on cyber terror? And specifically, how do the graphical representations of the online space that accompany this war impact our freedom and our civil rights? What might alternative efforts to map cyberspace look like? And this is an important question, one I'm going to leave open to everybody to either comment on now or hopefully come and talk to me later if you have any ideas. How can we potentially subvert these dominant maps of cyberspace and produce our own? Thank you. One second before I answer any questions, is there a moderator around who can tell me if I've got enough time to do so? I got 8 minutes? Okay. Well, I'll answer some questions then. Yeah. Right.
And so it's like you might want to put in your map these blocks.
You're kind of imagining a real world, old style cartographic representation of sort of relative internet freedom by country.
Not necessarily a cartographic map, but definitely something that would note that certain countries cannot access, at least not freely, the internet.
Right, and you raise a very important point, one that I forgot to really underline in my talk, which is that, on this jellyfish map, you don't see any potential barriers to connection, do you? You only see the connections, you don't see the blockages. Right.
That would indicate those blocks.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. Any other questions? Yeah, that's a really cool idea. I'd love to talk to you after and find out where I can access that to have a look at it. It sounds like a really interesting sort of political project, similar to the Hobo Diary, you know, turning the world upside down, was saying, well, you know, let's point out the fact that English is the dominantly spoken language online and that, you know, the United States gets the most of the news coverage. Bad English, yeah. Any more questions? Yeah, in the back. Thanks. All right, well, if there's no other questions, I look forward to talking to you guys one-on-one after the presentation. Thanks very much.